Welcome to Series 2 of the Rugby Buzz, a podcast brought to you by H&HB Events. My name is Mark Hartery, and I will be your host as I chat to rugby stars past and present about matches that they were involved in that remain highlights for them. Today, I'm delighted to be able to chat to the former Bath and England fullback, John Callard. John started his career at Newport before joining Bath, where he went on to become a club legend, appearing over 200 times, scoring over 2,000 points in all competitions. He won 5 England caps, scoring 69 points, and was selected for the Rugby World Cup in 1995. At Bath, he won 5 league titles and 5 cup finals in a stellar period for the club, and in 1998 played a pivotal part in their Heineken Cup victory over Brive, scoring all 19 points. After retiring, he embarked on a successful coaching career with Bath and then Leeds Tykes, and then went on to play a key part of the young player development at the RFU, being responsible for bringing through many of the players you see in the Premiership and England side today. John now runs his own sports coaching business, JC16, working across elite and grassroots sport. Well, hello, John, and welcome to the Rugby Buzz. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, very excited about this.
Good. Good, and I see you're sporting the original shirt there. That isn't bad at all. After 31 years, it still fits. So don't think I could get into anything I wore in 1990. Not both legs anyway, and bits. But yeah, no. Does it still feel good to have it on?
Well, when you mentioned about talking about a favourite game. And I thought, I've probably got a shirt for that somewhere in the garage, to the consternation of my wife, you know. And I thought, well, you know, hopefully this will bring back a lot of memories for a lot of people, because it was just one of those days. And yeah, it does feel great. And it's nice to go back in time, because there were a lot of good friends in that side. Sadly, one is gone. One of our family is gone, and there's, you know, God, he rest in peace, you know, Edgy up there. But it's still a family, and we still, you know, at times get together and have a moan and a bit of banter with each other. Yeah, so yeah, no, it's a great opportunity. Thank you.
Brilliant. No, I mean, we'll come on to the game in a bit, but before we do that, the time we're recording this, we're smack bang in the middle of the Six Nations. Been a strange one for England, really, in terms of, well, 2 defeats in the first couple of games. How do you see where England are at the moment?
I think they're struggling with their own identity at the moment, to be honest with you. We've got a fabulous squad. We've got strength in depth. We've got a nation that is passionate about rugby. And I think we're just struggling with our identity. And I think that is that, do we want to chuck it about and play it at all costs? Or do we want a gnarly pack of forwards who are going to just dominate sides? And I think we're caught between the two, because we're not committed enough to be the gnarly pack of forwards, because we give away penalties. And then we're living off the scraps of that by playing behind. So I think struggling with our identity. Okay, things haven't gone our way. So, but that, you know, Ireland didn't go their way when they're that man send off, and Scotland's under Ferguson, he had his man send off as well. So Wales have rolled their luck, and they deserve so, because I thought they were tremendous against England the last time out. You know, certainly the impact, you know, take Bigger off, Callum Sheedy comes on. Wow, looks like he's been playing international rugby all his life. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Kicks those goals, makes a difference. So the impact and the bravery of that bench, you know, Wayne Pivock with his team and the bench and the interactions. Also, I think, you know, if I'm getting into it, you know, discipline is something that can be easily sorted out. I don't think it's a big issue. Yes, it has cost England, but it's not a long-term problem. It's not going to go on forever. So it can be sorted out. If it ain't sorted out, the players will be dropped. That's the way you got to treat it. That's the way you got to treat it. So I think that... I think a little bit more identity. And also I feel against Wales, England were just one pass away from really, really causing Wales, you know, some serious questions, or posing some serious questions. Just one pass, they get their shape right, and then they play out the back with a forward. Now, if it's just played one more pass into that space where you've got Watson, Daly, and May exploiting a covering defence, they were just drunk. So I'm hoping that they'll discover that as well. So, you know, there's a lot worse things going on in the world at the moment. And we can go on about English rugby, and everybody can have their point at saying it so-and-so or so-and-so and so-and-so. There's a lot of other things going on. What we've got to remember as well, and, you know, I'm very proud of this fact, you know, being a rugby person first and foremost, is that people are making the effort to put these games on. They're going through sacrifices to put these games on. So they've got to live in the bubble. Yes. Okay. Yes. We know that there's, you know, financial reward, but you still, you know, that financial reward is such that you're away from your family for 8 weeks. You're away from your loved ones. You're away from a normal life, so to speak, or as normal as it could be at this stage. And I think, you know, credit to those people who are putting, you know, put themselves out to entertain us and give us something to talk about. So yeah, it might be not where we want to be at the moment. And that person or those people might not be the right people, but credit where credit's due for putting on a performance to give us something that we can smile about or talk about during the week.
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, when we were in the first lockdown and there was no live sport at all, and it makes you really appreciate it. Okay, there's no crowds at the moment. Hopefully that will change very shortly. But it does make a difference, doesn't it, to be able to switch on the telly and watch the Six Nations. And as you say, as rugby people, just talk about it. Oh, that's not right. That's not right. Wasn't that great? And England, as you say, I thought England were as impressive as they've been going forward in the Six Nations. So I don't think they're a million miles away. The discipline, as you say, is sortable. What about the kind of lack of game time with the Saris guys? Do you think that has an impact?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Then that goes down to selection, you know. Again, we've got our opinions, and this is what happens with sport. We can have our views. We're not having to go on anybody. Not personally having to go on anybody, but it comes down to selection. And you've got to ask yourself, would it have been right to play these players at the beginning of the tournament when they were rusty? And that's all. They're not bad players. They're not bad players. Far from it, you know. They are world-class players and would be the envy of any other team. But unfortunately, when you're not match sharp and your cognitive and your physical abilities are not aligned, so to speak, you might be just firing on one or two cylinders, as opposed to international rugby, you've got to be firing on all cylinders. And I think it did come back to crosses. So you're half late to a tackle, you're half yard early to competing for a ball. In international rugby, that equates to penalty. It's simple as. You're not on the game. Now, we're three games in, and hopefully now we should see that that penalty count come down and the turnover rate go up, and then we should see our performance start to blossom. But we can have our conjecture on what's happened. That's happened, but now you've got to sort it out as we unfold moving forward.
Yeah, most definitely. And away from the kind of international scene, obviously the Premiership is going on as well. And, you know, Bath, not a great start. Then they had that kind of winning run, obviously came to an end against Exeter last weekend. But how do you see Bath at the moment?
As a person that would crawl to Bath tomorrow, you know. love the place, love the club, love the old people there, that, you know, the fans and everything. I don't see it as where it should be. It should be top five, top four competing. And it's been like that for a little bit. Last year, we got into that playoff place. And I say we, you know, our family member, you know, not somebody who's coaching somebody else or whatever. We as a family member, because I do call it as the family. We should be competing on a regular basis. Now, there's some good lads coming through. The injuries haven't helped. And it's noticeable from watching the games is that when there's a certain group of people on the field, they're doing very well. Now, when time expires and then it becomes the coach's prerogative to pull them off, their performance dips. And that's something that I think down the line, you know, Bath have got to get that strength in depth so that they can make those changes. It was noticeable against the Northampton game, actually, where they were getting, you know, let's say comfortably pushed around up front. And then they change the front row and on come the artillery. And that was it. That was the game changer. And I thought that was a masterstroke because he's kept his weapons back until he needs to fire them. And they came out on top, you know. It's not where I want them to be, you know. But there again, you know, when I was lucky to play for Bath in an era that dominated the sport, I was very lucky, you know, a bit like Leicester did after this, you know. And, you know, it was a bit of a foregone conclusion when you watch those games. But you know, there's a bit of me now that you have to earn the right to win games. You have to put in everything that there is to perform. So it's a contest. It's a proper game. It's a challenge. Otherwise, the sport would be, you know, maybe like, I don't know, I'm just trying to think it. Maybe Man City, who are running away with the league, you know, and you're thinking, well, it's a foregone conclusion. There's nothing to play for. Whereas I think the competitiveness of those games that Bath are wearing at the moment, that's where we are. Yeah.
And the Premiership is hugely competitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There isn't an easy game at all now, which is fantastic.
And Mark, I would say, and this is just going back to my day, and I don't want to offend anybody by saying my day. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. My day was about you did everything when you left Lambridge. That was the training ground at Bath. You left everything on that training field, and you did everything to get that shirt. And if you were given that shirt, you didn't want to give it up. You know, your arm would be hanging off. You've got a pulled hamstring. Your knee is gone. You were not going to give that shirt up because, you know, if that shirt is given up to somebody else, you've got a hell of a job to get it back. Nowadays, it seems, well, you've got five games, six games. Doesn't really, you know, I know that's the modern era, and I'm not knocking that, but I'm just saying from my personal experience, you did everything. And you went above and beyond. So you do your extra training sessions, you get together with your mates, and you work on your skills and drills in your own time, as well as work.
I was going to say, you were amateur as well,
weren't
you?
Yeah. As well as work in order to get that shirt. And, you know, it was all worth it in the end because we had days like we did at the 1990 Cup final.
Yeah. And before we talk about that game, obviously, when you retired, you went into coaching and very successfully, into that coaching career. Spent a long time at the RFU, and then came away from that. So, what's John Callard doing now?
So, I run my own sports consultancy, JC Sinclair Limited. It really is an offshoot from my coaching days. I was a teacher by trade. I was trained as a teacher. I went on to do a master's at Bath University in educational management. So my background's education and development. So it was a natural progress to go into coaching after playing and then so on. I had 12 great years at the Union of being part of the pathway and the program. We had amazing times. I met some great people around the world. And also, you know, we look what we contributed in that time. 3 junior World Cups at under 20 level, never been done before, Grand Slams. And the amount of players now who come through that pathway, you know, that are playing for the senior side, it was the envy of the rugby world. Unbelievable time that came to an end. They were restructuring, and it happens, you know, nothing's forever. And, you know, I've got some great memories that I don't want to go by. So I went on, I could set up my own sport consultancy, which was around coaching, kick coaching, player development, coach development, but also pathway development as well, which I'm passionate about developing and building with companies, is building their own pathway to succession plan for the future. So leaving nothing unturned, because I'm a great believer that you develop your own and treat them well. They're going to give them, go beyond for you. And, you know, they're more likely to stay than chase the Holy Grail, so to speak. And I'm a great believer you can do that as a company. So we've had some tentative discussions about what a pathway looks like, taking the functionally fit skills, i.e. what are the necessary skills of the individuals that you want to build into your pathway, and then grow it from there. So that's what was part of my business. And, you know, that's in this current climate, as everybody else is, it's slow. And the other part of my business as well is coaching and development. And I suppose my speciality is kick coaching. So I've studied the mechanics of kicking, the biomechanics of kicking, and translated that into a training program with interventions for all individuals. So what I'm saying is we don't get a model and chuck it out there and say that's fit for everybody. The beauty about what I enjoy most, and I think about what I deliver, is that I am totally bespoke to the individual. So it's about you as the individual and how do we develop you and your traits, because under pressure you're going to go back to those traits, and we want you to work as naturally to that as well. So, you know, in the early days with the Fords, the Farrells, the Slades, the Browns, the Dailies, the Devotos, you know, and even the ones that make me smile, you know, and I've got to be honest about this, Ryan Lamb at Gloucester, you know, mm-hmm. It used to be the last person I used to see on just before, you know, broke for the weekend for the games, because clubs didn't like to see you on a Friday because they were preparing for games. So Thursday was the last session really in Gloucester with Ryan Lamb. And he was terrific. And the work that we used to do with goalkeeping. And then again, people like Shane Geraghty, who honestly, you know, he put his hand up to be a goal kicker, and you had to be honest, you know, your work, give him your all, you know, make sure that you've got an individual attention program for him. But underneath it, you think, I'm not sure if he's going to make it as a goal.
Yeah.
You can never tell him that.
No.
Never tell him that. But that's the beauty of it. That's the job that I do and I'm passionate about. So
yeah. And purely at elite sport level, John? Or?
No, we work at grassroots. And we try and more in the development cycle of grassroots.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair that you start putting yourself out to work with 12, 14 year olds and, you know, try and gain money off their parents. So that's not me. No, you've got to be of a certain level to be, you know, let's say, to be rewarded with your investment, you know, because you could go out and you can, you know, and I'm sure, well, I'm not sure at all, but you know, some parents will feel, oh yeah, you're working with young Johnny here at X, Y, and Z. No, I think, you know, let's see how things develop and then, you know, where we go from there.
Yeah. And is it just rugby?
No, funny enough, no. I got invited and employed by the Football Association to put their dead ball striking program into the FA. So working along under Dave Redding and Dan Ashworth and Matt Crocker, got into working with all the teams in terms of how we implement, build the pathway straight and first. What does it look like? How do we build it? What's the common terminology that we can use between S&C staff, conditioners, coaches, and medics, you know, developing the common language, because they might have what I call the pillar, so to speak, in my kicking action, i.e. that's the strong side that allows you to rotate around to kick. I call it, they might have all different expressions, so it might be lost in language, but we create a common language, and then we create a common intervention program for developing that as well. So I had some amazing some players to deal with, and I think, you know, I'm not going to chuck them out because it might be a miss of me, but you know, the engagement I had from the player, there was a bit of, you know, I'll be honest with you, the footballers were very, very sort of, you know,
what can a guy from rugby teach me?
Yeah. Teach me about kicking. Now, I met, and without giving the names away, I met an Irish international whose son was in the pathway, who came along to one of my sessions. And he went, wow, I wouldn't know where to begin. Now you make this. I wouldn't. And I've been in the sport all my life. He said, wow. And, you know, we had tremendous success with it. And it was very, very influential. And it's part of the DNA. They call it now the DNA of the FA. So we had tremendous success with it. But unfortunately, there was just one more step that I wanted to go with it. We developed it with the coaches and the players, and the terminology, and it's all there, all in part of the program. And Gareth Southgate allowed me to come in to work with his senior players before the USA game. I think it was Wayne Rooney's game, allowed me to come. And that was just an eye-opener as well. Him and Steve Holland were just fantastic, just unbelievable people. The bit that I was disappointed that we never got to, because Dan Ashworth left and things changed and then COVID came in and God knows what else, was that we never got to write in. This was the bit that was going to be really fascinating, was writing the program for the coach education. So how we develop coaches to develop this for the future. So, you know, taking it on a step. And we never got there. Maybe come back. I don't know. Hopefully, you know, instances like this, will rekindle some.
You touched on COVID, and you know, lots has changed for everybody over that. And you know, let's just hope. Just listening to you, and it's just fascinating to hear. You know, the work that goes in. You watch it on a Saturday afternoon or whatever, and you just go, oh, yeah, well, they're kicking a ball or whatever. but it's not that, and it's that again. It's those fine margins that, particularly at elite level, that make the difference. And we've all got to hope that, you know, you've got that far with the FA and on the rugby side as well. When things start to settle down, hopefully that won't have gone away, and it's still required and still needed. So, you know, fingers crossed that is the case. But it just sounds absolutely fascinating to listen to, and I'm sure you enjoy every minute of it.
Well, we do. There's ups and downs on a weekend. You know, you've got five kickers kicking on a weekend, and four of them are going well and one not so well. You know which one they're going to point out, don't you? The one who's not gone so well.
But it's great.
And also, I've had the fortune. So, you know, my consultancy just before COVID, we had Sales Sharks, who were brilliant, and Steve Diamond in particular, was very supportive. Warrington Wolves with Steve Price there, and then with the FA, and Brighton. Brighton's still on hold. We're still working with Brighton, but obviously from a distance. Mm. So, you know, I was very, you know, fortunate with four great clients there, and different regions, so to speak. So it's exciting times, and I people will know me personally, and this is something that Bath taught me as well, is your resilience. You know, when you're in a group of people like Halliday, Barnes, Chilcott, Hill, Redmond in particular, Hall, Edgerton, Robinson, you know, you certainly, Gus Scott, you become resilient, and you get knocked down, and they're not interested in you being knocked down. They're interested about how you get up, and you get knocked down again, and how you get up and get up and get up. And that was Bath. That taught me. That was a life lesson at Bath, you know. And I'll never, you know, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, and exactly that. I mean, leads on wonderfully to the game you've chosen as your favourite game, and you're taking us back under 31 years ago, 5th of May 1990, Twickenham Stadium, in the middle of redevelopment. So it wasn't 70 odd thousand. I think it was about 52,000 there, and watching it back, just looked like the most blistering hot day as well. I don't think I've seen so many people in the crowd without tops on as they're panning around. But you know, at that stage, you've mentioned all the names there in terms of that squad at that time. But to perhaps set up the final, Gloucester had just missed out, I think, on the championship, pipped by Wasps, I think, the previous week. You were the reigning holders, although it was your first final. And I think Bath had won 5 out of 6 leading up to that. So you know, it was set up, the whole West Country rivalry as well, Bath and Gloucester. Bath had a relatively comfortable ride through, score wise anyway. I'm sure they weren't through that. Harlequins, Headingley, Richmond in the quarterfinal, and then Moseley. And any of those particular games stand out, or was it as, again, don't wish to be rude, but as comfortable as it suggests?
No, I would say that no games were comfortable for us. Even the cup final wasn't comfortable, even though the scoreline suggested it. I remember all the way through, you know, and I was lucky to play, and I had John Webb, who was the England player at the time, snapping at my heels, and you know, the club stuck with me because they could have easily said John Webb would play, and you know, I'm very grateful for that fact. But you've got to earn that and play that. And I know Webby was sort of winding down a little bit, and I always remember, I've got to play well, I've got to make sure that I'm not the one that, you know, I'm not the one that makes the mistake, or, you know, there's a fear of failure, massive fear of failure within that group. But I always remember after each game, you know, finishing the game, and you sit there in the change rooms after each and every one of those rounds, it's nothing like a cup final until you've been to a cup final, lad, you know, and next game. It's nothing like a cup final till you've been to a cup final with Bath, lad, and, you know, and then the semi-final come up. You don't know what a cup final's like until you've been. And it was all this, wow, this must be a massive occasion. You know, there was always that, you know, the other guys have been there, you know, apart from Addy and I think Kevin Withy, even though Kevin Withy was part of the squad and he might have travelled with them. I don't think he actually played before. Mm. But, you know, there was all this, wow, this wow factor about this cup final, because the city, you know, basically the last one out, turn the lights off, just go to the final. It was massive. So it was all the build up about that, really, than any standouts.
Yeah, and you mentioned the build up, and we touched again earlier. Of course, it was still amateur. All of your jobs and other things going on. So that week up to the leading up to the final on the weekend, what was the build up like? What process would you have gone through?
So remembering back then, we would have had a chalk and talk session in those days. Might have been a bit of VT as well, and an old VT, you know, somebody at the front pushing buttons. None of this fandangle stuff that you have now, you know, 3D images and all that business. We might have had a talk. I think we might have, you know, raised a few aspects of the game. I know for a fact going into that game, there was quite an emotional presence about it, because we went to Gloucester and got comfortably pumped. I say comfortably pumped, you know, it was 13 something or what the score line, but we were beaten up, and there was a bit of, you know, retribution. We needed to put a marker down, and there was a bit of looking at the forwards, right, you know, you need to perform, and, you know, the forwards are looking at the back, well, you keep hold of the ball, and there was a bit of us v them leading up to it. So there was quite a bit of emotional sort of play on the players, and for me it just whizzed by, you know, the whole week. It was only, you know, remember, we only had two sessions. And one of the big factors as well, yeah, one of the big factors was it was the early session during the week. So it would have been a Monday, I think it was. Yeah, Monday night. And by that time, the season's finished. So they've taken down all the stands at the rec, but the ticket office was in front of the changing rooms.
Yeah.
Or just there. And there would be 700-800 people queuing up to get their cup final tickets whilst we're training. And that was a big, wow. This is what they talk about a cup final week, you know. This is what it's all about. I mean, it didn't happen this particular year, but there was a couple of years later where we got to a final, and Kevin Yates and Ben Clark went off on one against each other, and then both packs piled in, and there was a massive brawl on a Monday night in front of 700 spectators. And, you know, it all dusted down and everybody parted their way, sort of thing. And some old wag said, oh, they're up for it for the weekend, and, you know, we're going to be all right for this game, as they do. And that was it. You know, it was just, yeah, there's so many memories. I know we digress about that game, but it just went so quickly, the build-up. I'll tell you what was very, very interesting about the cup final as well. Part of the cup final is getting to the cup final, as I learnt about. And then what you also learn about, it's all about the clobber. So, ooh, you know, new blazer, new chinos, ooh, okay. Some shirt and tie, and you get some shoes and new tracksuit and all that. Oh, it's all, you know, it's old school. It's not about, you know, get all the clobber and all that. Well, whoever the person was, because the player rep organizes the kit, organizes the sort of after-match kit. I remember myself and Nigel Redmond doing it a few years later. But in this instance, and I always remember, it stands out to me, someone had given us short-sleeve shirts with Sweb on it, white, for the cup final. And also they decided, short-sleeve shirts, decided to give us cufflinks with them as well. So that's honest truth. That's honest gospel of going to the cup final. So you're thinking, well, I'll come in handy one day, but not
one day. So for the cup final itself, then, would you have travelled up on the Saturday, or would you have stayed up overnight on the Friday?
No, and this is one of the things that Bath were always ahead of their time. They would stay the night before a cup final away. The Runnymede mm-hmm. was their favourite hotel. It's the first time I'd been to the Runnymede. We always stayed away together as a team when we played away, even Bristol down the road. 9 miles away, we'd stay the night before the game down there. And all the players would eat together. And I'll be honest with you, we'd have a couple of glasses of wine together, nothing silly, but there'd be some wine on the table and people get to relax and recount the stories. In fact, and again, a true story, one of my first times I stayed away was Bristol away, and everybody was sitting along this long table. And then all of a sudden, and I think, you know, and God love him up there, Edgy. I think Edgy played a part in this as well. And then all of a sudden there was this, it just went quiet. And then there was shaking, rattling like that. And then somebody said, it's just the 2:30, and boom, went past. And I didn't think anything of it. And then 10, 15 minutes later, it started rattling again. 2:40, it's just gone past. Boom, boom. I thought, what's this all about now? And I looked, and they were all sort of like, you know, Richard Hill in particular, he always had a little cheeky grin, and he was smiling like this. Well, what they were mimicking was Andy Robinson's house, because he bought a house on the back of a railway line. And oh, really? He said he didn't need a clock, because you could just judge when the intercities would go past, everything would start shaking out. Well, that was the sort of banter that we had. And, you know, and poor Robbo, he was raging with it. But that the sort of things that you got up to when, you know, you went away together. You didn't eat in small groups, you all ate together on a table. And it did have that closeness and the feel about it.
Yeah, yeah. And the day itself, as we alluded to, boiling hot day. The shirt you're wearing, I can't imagine isn't the easiest to be wearing on a day like this. That was there. What do you remember that kind of journey to Twickenham, and what's the process of that?
Can I? Well, I'll just go back the day before before traveling up to the thing, because I think it's important. You know, people understand. You know, you said he was amateur, and everybody would meet at the rec to go on the bus, and that's everybody. And then we'd come across just up past, over the bridge, past this fire station onto London Road. And then we'd stop. And I always think it was Mrs. O's shop. It was an Indian lady who ran the newsagent and grocery shop. And we'd always stop there, you know, some boys would buy some crisps or Cokes. And this particular day, I think Richard Seaman, who was the team secretary at the time, he actually bought a whole box of lollipops and things to share, because it was a lovely day, and share on the bus. And Mrs. O would each and individually, no, you better perform, you better perform, you better perform. It was like a pep talk before we left the city. Yeah, and don't come back without that cup, she would say. And she would get on the bus and start pointing the finger at everybody. And yes, Mrs. O, yes, Mrs. O. It was fabulous. Honestly, it was fabulous. And then we'd travel up to the hotel and you know, get there sort of mid-afternoon, and then you would, some guys would go for a walk. They had the spa facilities. Some of us would go outside, play a bit of croquet. It was just so relaxing. And then all lunch together, dinner together. Nothing too major in terms of team meetings in those days. You know, very relaxed, very sort of down people. Bear in mind, it was my first one, and I was buzzing. I couldn't sleep, taking everything in. Where to all the other old hats, you know, it was just like another day for them. Yeah. And I always remember the next day getting up for breakfast again. Everybody would get up at the same time, and they'd all be together, eating together in the sort of sunroom at the Runnymede. And it was just, yeah, you know, those were the memories. You know, nowadays somebody would get up a bit late and have his bit different or do something a bit different, you know, each into their own. But it was very collective sort of movement.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what kind of binds you together then as that whole team. And the team, looking back at the game and the teams that were selected, you looked down that bar team sheet and you know, they're all for particularly for rugby people everywhere, it's household names, isn't it? I was going to say 15-1, but of course 16 through to one. And probably the only, if you like, unknown as such was Kevin Withy, in terms of, you know, he'd come into the side and replace John Hall, and it just you know, spoke of that great Bath side of the 80s and 90s. And of course, a 19-year-old on the wing, Adi Adebayo, and it it just worked from there. What was it like coming into that team with, you know, that had been so successful? Was that, as you say, you played for the jersey and you were desperate to keep hold of it, but that must have been something else for a relatively young guy to come into that setup with all of those players.
I mean, I can't speak for Addy, because Addy was a very confident young man and huge ability, unbelievably powerful, you know, modern day winger, if you like. Addy, I can't speak for, I can only speak for myself. And Kevin Withy obviously took John Hall's place. I think John, I'm not sure if it was because of suspension or he was injured. I don't know. But Kevin came in, and you could see why Kevin's involvement, because there was a stalwart on the bench, Nick Maslin, who was a club legend, you know, playing for the second team and that, but didn't play. So I can only assume that Kev Withy was brought in because of that mobility to try and move this big Gloucester pack around. And it was a big Gloucester pack. And what we had, the mauling up at King's Home a few months earlier, I think was probably the thinking behind that. But for me personally, as I've alluded to earlier, it was about the fear of failure coming into that side. I didn't want to give the shirt up. I wanted to be part of something special, because they, you know, those names there, the household names, you know, I wanted to be part of that. But I didn't want to be the person that let them down. You know, I wanted, it was a fear of failure that drove me to being in that side. So I was lucky, I suppose, that I used not nerves to my advantage, because I don't like nerves as a word. I use my adrenaline to my offensive, and use that to my advantage, and not dropping in. And also, you know, in my early days there, you kept your head down and you kept quiet, you know, spoke when you were spoken to. Don't upset anybody. Don't come up with anything. Just keep your head down. You know, if I ask a question, make sure you answer it, and, you know, without offending anybody. And that was my early years at Bath. And that's the way I felt as part of that team.
Yeah. And the game itself, John, you'd have said on paper, as I say, given where Gloucester were, and you know, the forward orientated game that they had, and you'd, as you say, you'd lost at King's Home a couple of months earlier, to have that start, you know, the first half was just, you know, must have been an absolute dream. Four tries, totally dominated, 25-0 at halftime, and some fantastic tries as well. It must have been almost the perfect half of rugby from Bath's perspective, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But, you know, if before the game, and this is why you joined Bath, or I thought joined Bath, and the preparation before the game, I felt as much had to do with the performance as when we were playing, if that makes sense. I can remember our team meeting in the morning, and Tom Hudson had said, right, I've got somebody to speak to you, and this is very important, and you better all listen. And, you know, you can see some of the other players are old hats who've been around, so like, whatever. And I was like, oh, what's this? And in came, I can't remember his name, and I do apologize. I don't want to offend him by him saying that, but came in and gave us a lecture about the heat, humidity, the loss of fluid, and that you can take preventions for this happening, and you can improve your performance by 15% if you do these measures. And he gave us a lecture on it, and I was thinking, right, so what you had to do was take small sips often, and every time there was a break, you got over to the shade and you stood there. So luckily we were scoring points. Their guys were stood behind the posts, and we were going to the shade because we were instructed to do that, to make sure that we're there. Even to the game, and it stays, you know, this is, they said, right, you wear your white tops, you wear them open, you wear the baggy tracksuit bottoms, and you relax, let the air, you know, you keep yourself cool. And I always remember going out onto the field, and Nigel Redmond in particular mentioned this. He said, I think we're going to be all right, yeah? I said, why? I said, well, you know, look at us and look at Gloucester. Gloucester were suited and booted, ties and shirts and blazers on, and or some had blazers off, and, you know, were sort of looking very smart, and, you know, but they just looked uncomfortable. And I don't know whether they traveled down the night before or they came down on the bus. So if they came down on the bus, you know, in that condition like that, we're thinking, oof, you know, our preparation here might just give us a good start. Not win the game, but give us a good start. And as it was, it turned out that way in the first half.
Yeah, and the tries themselves, Kevin, with you, we've already mentioned. He steals this Gloucester line out on just about halfway, and just no stopping him. Rode a couple of tackles. Okay, you can say maybe they weren't the greatest tackles in the world, but you still got to ride them and go through. And he just kept going and going and going. Yeah. And then all of a sudden he's over. So again, from his perspective, into the side for John Halls, that bang, and he scored the first try. Amazing.
Yeah. And what I remember about that, because obviously I was a long way away, what I remember about that was the crowd, the absolute sort of passion strings that it touched. The crowd the place started shaking when he scored that try. And I thought, this is surreal. It's scoring a try at the Rec with 4,000 or 5,000 people at it, or getting beaten at Gloucester, with 13,000 people at it, but 52,000. Yes, there was a lot of Gloucester fans there, but the Bar fans just the place rocked. I remember that try, and that sort of like woof lifted you another level. It just took you to an outer stratosphere. You were unbelievably pumped by this feeling. And the other thing that I think that probably that did to us was scraps of possession against this good pack. They were a good pack. They were good. Yeah. And also, you talk about their pack versus their backs. I mean, I remember in that second half, Gloucester run us ragged.
Yeah.
Mogg, Caskey, Tim Smith, Hannaford, Hammett, they started pulling the strings. We were under the cosh. But I think what that did early with Kevin Willie early on, it said to us, any scraps we can turn into our benefit. Mm. One line-out ball, Jerry sized through, freeze to Swifty, comes back to Jerry, like good centres, pass and follow, get a second touch, bang, he glides in. Myself, I was very fortunate. I caught a high ball, not a lot on, just put it up, speculatively chased it. It bounced my way. That's, good fortune. But there were just scraps that we were sort of building on. And the other thing to remember about the game, and I know we haven't talked about the second half, Gloucester were playing really well. I know John Gadd, and what I can remember of it, today's day, that wouldn't, there's no argument for it. So it's gone, it's happened. Is that we scored, I think Mbugu, Redmond, Dorr, all forwards scored, but they weren't from driving plays.
They weren't.
They were all open plays, players coming on the forward. I thought we played a great brand of rugby that day. That was probably fitting from my point of view. I was lucky to play in 6 cup finals with Bath through my time, and that includes the European Cup final. It was probably the most complete game, I think, that we put together.
Yeah, yeah. And as I say, 25-0 at halftime, and I don't know the answer to this, so perhaps did you go back into a changing room at Twickenham at halftime? I know in other games, and again, watching these back and doing the for the podcast, and you go, of course, I'd forgotten that. People didn't, they didn't go back into the changing rooms. Perhaps not so bad when it was, lovely weather. Not great when it's hammering down with rain and the wind's blowing and so on. But yeah. It just, you kind of forget that, and you come out second half, Barnsley kicks another penalty. And from that moment on, as you'd said, Gloucester really came into their own.
Oh, absolutely.
They had, to all intents and purposes, had you absolutely on the ropes. And, there were a couple of drop passes. They didn't quite go to hand. And again, as you say, the pack had been built up, but it was the likes of, Mogg, he played 78 and 82, I think, in cup finals for Gloucester. And he was brilliant that day. Absolutely brilliant. Wherever the ball was, he seemed to be there. And then of course, you had the sending off, John Gadden, as you say, it was clear cut. Fred Howard did amazing to even see it in that melee, didn't he? Without video refs and so on. But I think it was Edgy that that he stamped on, and as you've alluded to a couple of times, you know, really sad news a few weeks back when we heard of his passing. He was a Bath legend, but any special memories?
I mean, he always had time for everybody, Edgy. Mm. And he was probably one of the first people of the group that we had. You know, we hung around with after games. You know, not everybody stayed together after games, but there was small groups. And I remember, you know, myself, Redman, Barnes, Hill, Chilcott, and Edgerton would be in a group that would go to Bristol, and we'd go to Bristol as a group there. And he was always larger than life, always had a story on somebody, always had time for everybody. You know, a really, really great bloke and a great rugby player as well. You know, and you know, played pranks, as I said earlier on, with the Bristol things as well. Sadly, gone amongst our time. Not related to Bath. I remember he got a cap at Fiji, where literally his boots were undone. They were just basically put on, not tied up or anything. And there was an injury to so-and-so, somebody being taken off. And he just managed to get across the white line, across the white line, get his feet over the line. And the final whistle went, and it counted as a cap, as he kept telling everybody.
Brilliant.
So, you know. Brilliant. And I think also he was involved with the squads 87-91, but had to pull out with injury. I mean, he's a great bloke. And, you know, it's hard to think that one of our family, as I call it, has gone, has taken from him. Mm. But he, you know, he'll be missed, but he won't be forgotten.
No.
You know?
No, definitely. And hugely underrated as a player as well.
Yeah, yeah. And you think his abilities, you know, ball carrier and line-out strengths, you know, what that did to the balance of the back row. So that let Robbo be the fetcher. You know, Robbo played that role, the old-fashioned seven role. Right, Robbo, get to nine. If you can't get to nine, follow it, get to 10. If you can't get to 10, get to 12, get to 13. And you just go across until you stop. So he played that fetching role as a nuisance. And then you got the likes of when he was playing with John Hall or Paul Simpson, you know, those big sort of marauding ball carriers. And then you got Edgy then, who played the line-out role and play a sophisticated role. So he actually, you know, his ability allowed other people to shine as well. And I think that's a good point there, that one thing that we had at Bath, it's not about you shining as an individual. What are you going to do to help another person next to you shine? What are you going to do to help them? And that was another point that I've taken into my coaching, certainly from my Bath days. It's not about me and what I do for myself. It's about what I do for my teammates and what they do for everybody else that will be successful. You know, what are you going to do to make other people shine? And I thought that was, you know, it's something again that comes from that. You know, Edgy was certainly part of that with the way he played in the back row.
Yeah, brilliant. And you say, sadly, gone far too soon, but won't be forgotten, as you quite rightly say, John. And obviously the stamping, you know, Gloucester were right back in it. I think Kevin Dunn had scored, and I think there was an amazing stat from the game. I think it was well into the second half before Gloucester actually had a kick at goal, you know, that were anywhere near. And that just, you know, proves how well the first half had gone. But it was one of those kind of games of two halves. They just didn't perhaps, you know, exploit it with one or two more tries. And it could have been a tight last quarter then, apart from the sending off. And
well, it's sorry, Mike, there's two points there. Just before half time, they were attacking and all over us. Swifty pulls an interception out and goes 90 yards.
Yes.
So that's possibly a 12-point swing. Second half, they come out. Yes, they get that try. They had a penalty early on, Tim Smith missed a penalty. Then they had that try. And then they were pushing. So all of a sudden, you take those out and the penalty in, take Swifty's try out, put a try on there. All of a sudden, you know, 50 minutes gone, it could have been, you know, 18 or whatever it is, you know, 17, whatever, 15, you know, going into that last game. And the way they were coming into the game and they were playing the game, they had the momentum all with them that period. And I think then we were lucky to get a try. Swifty got his second try, and that really, you know, John Gadd obviously sending off, and then Swifty getting a try, and then that was it really for them.
Mm. And you've already said it, but you look at the score sheet and you see the names of Dore, Redmond and Ebogu on the try scoring, and you think, as you said, they're going to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 yards out, you know, pick up off the back of a ruck and just drive over, or a drive from a line out or whatever. Mm. But they weren't, were they? They were three cracking tries.
Rugby football tries.
Yeah, and Graham Dawes' try again. Withy, I think picks up, and a beautiful offload. You know, we purr about that in today's game, but you just think that this kind of soft hands to Dawes, and then he still had a bit of work to do to go over. Yeah. And the same with Redmond. Although Nige did. It was a bit more of a bulldoze for Nige. There wasn't any airs and graces about it. It was fairly direct, but it was the build up to that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the play that went there. And, you know, credit to Redmond at that time in the game, you know, still putting himself in a supporting role, bearing all the rucks and all the tackles he's had to hit. He's still getting himself in that position to add weight to our attack, you know. And that again, epitomize what we were about. You know, you're working hard all the time. You're not going to let anybody down. You're going to be accountable. You want the ball in your hands, not, oh, I don't want it, you know, somebody else can have it today. No, it was about us, individuals working for us as a team and putting yourself up there all the time. And that just, you know, highlights, you know, Redmond, Bugu and Dawes tries, highlights their sort of work rate for the team. Bear in mind those scrums. It, you know, if you go back and watch those scrums nowadays, there was sort of 5 yards apart and just charge in.
And again, the line outs as well. Oh. You know, the line outs there was proper athleticism in terms of, you know, no lifting. It relied on you getting off the ground. But it was anything goes, wasn't it? You know, people were piling through and looking back at the game, you look at the scrum halves. And the scrum halves these days go, oh, you know, that's rubbish ball, and I can't. What do you expect me to do with that off the top of the line out? You know, hardly any went to scrum halves' hands. They were bobbling about on the floor and trying to get rid of them. And you had the whole pack coming through on them. So yeah, it does take you back. You forget, don't you? You forget when you stood on the stood on terraces and watched those games. Just as you say, the scrums, they were almost, you know, 5-10 meters apart, and they ran in. The second Fred Howard calls a scrum, the second rows are already linked up. They're already linked up. There's no. They're linked up, ready to jump into it. So yeah, the other thing is that, you know, substitutions were only injury.
Yeah.
So these guys were playing, you know, 80 minutes full on, and it was, you know, it's a proper game of rugby. You know, there's the rucking was something to behold, in those days, and they still played for 80 minutes. There was no, you're in the front row, you can do your 50 minutes and then come off and have a breather. So to score those tries at the end was brilliant, and of course Barnsley let Simon Halliday convert the last one, which was it his last game? I think
it was his last game for Bath, but I think he went on to, I think he played at Harlequins for maybe a season after that. I think, and understandably so, you know, he was following a business career, you know, a banking career in London, and you can understand that, you know, a great servant of Bath. I'm privileged to say that I had the pleasure of playing in the same side as Simon Halliday, because I have no doubt, and I'll put this out there, you know, Simon Halliday playing today in today's teams, he would be a £1 million player. And when he was at his peak, he was a great player, skillful. He had density. I don't mean that between the ears. I mean, he had weight. He could tackle. He could sidestep. A great thinker of the game. Very articulate. I had the privilege of playing in the same side as Halliday. It was his last game, and to get that kick. you know, nice when it you finish that way. But I think he'd probably be more satisfied knowing Haller's, that he could sign off with Bath with such an emphatic win rather than having a conversion underneath the post and the limelight that he deserved then, by the way. But I think he would probably, you know, knowing Halliday as I do, would probably quietly reflect on, yeah, that was a special
a job well done, yeah,
a special day. And that's that's Haller's as a bloke. You know, I got on very well with him enjoyed his company, and you know, he was a fabulous player. I mean, you put them together, Guscott and Halliday, you know, if you put those into a modern team, you wouldn't go wrong. You couldn't go wrong. You couldn't go wrong.
No. And the celebration after?
Well, you know, I was, you know, probably, you know, looking around and saying, wow, this is fantastic, you know. Great. There's a lot of them where it's a job done, and you know.
Yeah, there's another one.
that's it. That's the expression. Boom, whatever. Again, about the experience of going to the cup final was coming out of that final and driving home, and you're going down the M4 and you're passing bus after bus after bus of Bath supporters, and that's what it meant. That's what it meant. And I always remember, and we always, any time we stayed in London, we'd always go to the Pheasant, which was off Junction 14, for the team would stop there, pub, just off the thing there. We'd stop and push in and have a few beers. And I remember this particular time, as you go off the junction, you could see that the pub was packed. You know, there was bus after bus parked outside. Obviously, a lot of supporters, probably Gloucester and Bath, had both stopped there. And we turned the other way, went the other way of the motorway. It's literally on parallel to the place. We went to a place called the Tally Ho, where we were the only people in there celebrating the cup final. Yeah, and it was, you know, not chucking about, you know, spraying stuff around. It was very reserved, very civilized, you know, good old stories, you know, and, you know, Cooch going around, he said, you did all right today, young'un. Yeah, not bad you, not bad you. And, you know, in a civilized manner, and come on, we're having a drink, so to speak. And that was great. And, you know, you get back to Bath and the clubhouse and you know, it's packed and it's great, you know, great feeling. And you think, yeah, like you said, job well done. But always after a cup final or winning the league, whatever, the Sundays were reserved for Jack's house. Okay. So Jack would throw at his house, and Jack would be around as he normally would be. Wouldn't be right in the centre of the party. Jack was one that would be quietly sitting there, and you'd go in and you'd find him, you know, watching the TV with his glass of wine while everybody else is like that. And I can always remember, I thought, cool, this is interesting, you know, Jack, you know, and Sue, his wife, his lovely wife, was sort of, you know, on parade and putting, you know, being the host and being great. And, you know, there were so, and it was wives and girlfriends as well, you know, it was everybody. Okay. And it was just a big family affair. But I do remember Barnsley, the little sneak that he was, you know, somebody said, right, somebody go and entertain Jack for 20 minutes. And that's very interesting. You know, I like to keep my ears open going. I said, go and entertain Jack. So Cooch or somebody would go and start talking to him, what about the game, Jack? And that's while Barnsley sneaked down into his wine cellar and started raiding all the finest red wine he could bring and bring it up and started, well, it was too late. They were already open before Jack could even mention it. But you could even see that, you know, even the plotting didn't stop at any level at Bath Rugby. There was always something going on to gain an advantage somewhere along the line. They were great days, and you know, and credit's got to go to Jack, you know, Jack and Tom Hudson, and sadly Dave Robson's not with us. But you know, when I joined Bath and meeting these three coaches, so to speak, and their foresight and their sort of forward thinking and their ability to think ahead and plan and how they wanted the team, they weren't just good coaches. These guys, these were selectors. And there's a difference between selecting and coaching. Selecting is an art. And I think personally, myself, we don't pay enough attention to it in this country. Mm. You know, the selection process in itself about identifying players, identifying for the roles they've got to play and how to play and what you want from them. And I think these three guys were, you know, were top of the game. I was very fortunate to be exposed to them and being able to be in a team that was led by them. Even though I hated them the next year because they dropped me straight away for John Webb. but you know, you get exposed in your life, playing life, and they influence you. But it's the secret to this, to anybody who comes out of playing and want to be, is don't listen to one person. Listen to everyone. You know, listen to everyone and make your own judgments about the way you want you to go. Don't be indoctrinated and the way the game should be going. You know, invest time for yourself to be the best coach you can be. And that might be changing things. Take a piece from here, take a piece. I see so many people come out in their coaching setup and they will follow the similar style of the last coach that they've been coached by. Yeah. And they're better than that. They're better than that. And that's where I think that this country really, you know, that we've got so many talented people who could go into coaching, is develop your own styles, develop your own things, and follow your own dreams and roots. And also be, you know, and don't be shy of the fact. Practice being a good selector, because that's it. I believe selecting is probably more important than the coaching side.
Yeah, and you know, that's true not only in sport, but that's true right across business as well, isn't it? You know, you see, in, even in a business environment, you see so many people trying to emulate that great boss that they had, but they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and it is about taking those little bits, but then adding them into your style, isn't it? And, you know, that's a really good point.
And Jack, you know, as people will be known, and he should be praised for this, Jack held down a very, very high power job, you know, at Golden Wonder, the Chris Funtry. And he was also on Dal Getty's board, I understand, as well. So this is a man that's operating right at the top of industry.
Oh, yeah.
And he's transferring those skills for us as rugby players. He's making us a better rugby player, a better rugby team, and, you know, a better product by bringing those skills to the team. So credit, you know, credit's got to go to Jack. You know, everybody loved having a dig at Jack, you know, when was the last time he bought a drink and all that business. And, you know, we all do that, but credit where credit's due. Tom, Dave and Jack, you know, were leaders before their time.
Yeah, most definitely. John, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting about that, your life after rugby. But the great thing about doing these podcasts is the ability to go back and relive it myself and to listen to the passion and the insights that you know you've just brought about that particular game has been absolutely fascinating. John, I thank you for your time. I wish you all the very best with JC16 once we get back to normal. And thank you for choosing such a fantastic game.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a real, real pleasure. And, you know, if we bring a smile to somebody who was there that day, Gloucester or Bath, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Gloucester or Bath, then I think it's been absolutely worth it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the new series of the Rugby Buzz. We do hope that you're enjoying these podcasts. If you are, then why not share them with your friends and contacts? And of course, leave us a review. Don't forget, if you missed any of the episodes from Series 1 or Series 2, you can still catch up on them wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. It's been a busy few weeks for HNHB since the roadmap was announced, rescheduling all of our previously postponed events. During August, we have now rebooked our theatre nights with Nigel Owens in Worcester, and also Sam Warburton in Port Talbot and Barry. And we have a new date for our Rugby Dinner of the Year at Hatherley Manor Hotel and Spa in Gloucester with World Rugby Chairman and England legend Sir Bill Beaumont, which will now take place on November the 4th. Details of all these events can be found on our website, www.hnhb.buzz. We're also supporting the brilliant rugby charity Wooden Spoon with an online auction over the next few days. So if you get a chance to have a look at that and win some amazing prizes while supporting a great charity at the same time, then please do. Follow our social media channels on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn or Instagram for more details. And don't forget, if we can help any sports clubs, schools or charities with their fundraising, then please get in touch. We'll be back with you next time for another episode. But in the meantime, be safe.